The Personal History of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens.
In language would access impart the power they feel so well. There may perhaps in such a scene some recollection be.
Part 7. Wickfield and Heap.
Of days that have as happy been, and you'll remember me.
I don't know how it came about, for my misfortunes were still real enough, but my meeting with Agnes had quite changed my attitude to them. I now saw my troubles as challenges to be overcome. I must take my woodman's axe in my hand, clear my way through the forest of difficulties, and win my prize. And my prize was Dora. Dr. Strong had responded very swiftly to my letter, and I was to see him at his house in Highgate, at 10 o'clock in the morning.
My dear Copperfield, your proposal is very gratifying and agreeable to me, but don't you think you could do better? You achieved distinction, you know, when you were with us.
Doctor, if you'll take such time as I have and think it worth £70 a year, you'll do me a great service.
Will I? Will I indeed? Then you must promise me that when you can do better, you will. On your word now.
On my word, sir. Then we are agreed.
We are agreed.
Thank you. Sir, I remember you'd started researching your dictionary while I was still at school. Am I to have the pleasure of working on that?
You've hit it. Yes, it is my dictionary. You may find my papers are not quite in order. Mr. Jack Malden has been helping me, and he isn't used to such work. You'll remember Mr. Malden, my wife Annie's cousin.
Indeed I do. Then he's come back from India.
Yes, yes. He couldn't bear the climate, you know. Mrs. Markleham was quite vexed about him, poor thing. So we've got him at home again, and we've bought him a little patent place, which agrees with him much better.
I enjoyed my work with Dr. Strong, and although I was kept pretty busy, up at 5 in the morning and home at 9 or 10 at night, I felt that the more I tired myself out, the more I was doing to deserve Dora. Indeed, I still burned with impatience to do more, and in pursuit of this, I went to see Traddles. I had heard that many distinguished men began life by reporting the debates in Parliament, and I wanted to know how to set about it.
My dear Copperfield, this is an undertaking. It requires a mastery of shorthand.
How long would that take?
Several years, I shouldn't wonder.
Good. I'll begin tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
I'll buy a book and work at it in the office. I'll take down the speeches in court for practice. I'll master it, Traddles.
Why? I'd no idea you were such a determined character. I'm very glad to see you, Copperfield. I have a letter for you from Mr. Micawber, sent care of me.
How is he?
Pretty well, I think, but his letter will tell you. Here.
Thank you.
What? Listen to this.
You may possibly not be unprepared to receive the intimation that something has turned up.
Traddles, at last. Can this be true? Read the rest of it.
I may have mentioned to you that I expected
such an event to occur. And now I am about to establish myself in one of the provincial towns of our favoured island in immediate connection with one of the learned professions. Mrs. Micawber and her offspring will accompany me. In bidding adieu to the modern Babylon, where we have undergone many vicissitudes, I trust, not ignobly, Mrs. Micawber and myself cannot forget that we part, it may be for years, and it may be forever, with an individual linked by strong associations to the altar of our domestic life. If, on the eve of such a departure, you will accompany our mutual friend Mr. Thomas Traddles to our present abode, and there reciprocate the wishes natural to the occasion, you will confer a boon on one who is forever yours, Wilkins Micawber. My dear Copperfield, you and Mr. Traddles find us on the brink of migration and will excuse any little discomforts incidental to that position.
Of course. Congratulations to both.
Dear Mr. Copperfield, thank you. My family may consider it banishment if they please, but I am a wife and mother, and I will never desert Mr. Micawber.
Oh, I'm sure of that, Mum.
Thank you, Mr. Traddles. That is my view of the obligation I took upon myself when I repeated the irrevocable words, I, Emma, take thee, Wilkins. The conclusion I reached was that I never could desert Mr. Micawber, and though it is possible I may be mistaken in my view of the ceremony, I never will.
My dear, I'm not conscious that you're expected to do anything of the kind.
I am aware, my dear Mr. Copperfield, that I am now about to cast my lot among strangers, and I am also aware that my family, to whom Mr. Micawber has written in the most gentlemanly terms announcing that fact, have not taken the least notice of it.
Oh.
I may augur from their silence that they object to the resolution I have taken, but I should not allow myself to be swerved from the path of duty, even by Papa and Mama, were they still living. It may be a sacrifice to immure oneself in a cathedral town.
Oh, you're going to a cathedral town?
To Canterbury. In fact, my dear Copperfield, I am contracted to our friend Heap to serve him in the capacity of, and to be, his confidential clerk.
To Uriah Heap?
Yes. On Mrs. Micawber's suggestion, an advertisement was placed by me, and our friend Heap responded to it. Our friend Heap is a man of remarkable shrewdness, and I desire to speak of him with all possible respect. He has not fixed the positive remuneration at too high a figure, but he has made a great deal in the way of extrication from pecuniary difficulties contingent on the value of my services. On the value of those services, I pin my faith. I have already some acquaintance with the law as a defendant on civil process.
I particularly wish Mr. Micawber to be careful that he does not, in applying himself to this subordinate branch of the law, place it out of his power to rise ultimately to the top of the tree. I am convinced that Mr. Micawber, giving his mind to a profession so adapted to his fertile resources and his flow of language, must distinguish himself. Now, for example, Mr. Traddles, a judge or even a chancellor, does an individual place himself beyond the pale of those preferments by entering on such an office as Mr. Micawber has accepted?
My dear, we have time enough to consider those questions.
Micawber, no. Your mistake in life is that you do not look forward far enough. You are bound, in justice to your family, if not to yourself, to contemplate the furthest point to which your abilities may lead you. Now, Mr. Traddles.
Why, the plain truth, Mrs. Micawber, the real prosaic fact.
I wish to be prosaic and literal as possible on a subject of such importance.
The real fact is that this branch of the law, even if Mr. Micawber were a regular solicitor, has nothing to do with that.
Oh.
Only a barrister is eligible for such preferments, and Mr. Micawber could not be a barrister without being entered at an inn of court as a student for 5 years.
Do I understand, Mr. Traddles, that at the expiration of that period, Mr. Micawber would be eligible as a judge or chancellor?
He would be eligible, yes.
Thank you. That is sufficient. My anxiety is set at rest. I've always been of the opinion that Mr. Micawber possesses the judicial mind, and I hope he is now entering a field where that mind will develop itself and take a commanding station.
My dear, we will not anticipate the decrees of fortune. Copperfield, your glass. Traddles, my friend, your glass.
Thank you, Mr. Micawber. We must drink to your success in your new career.
Indeed we must.
Mr. Micawber and Mrs. Micawber. I propose a toast to your future.
Mr. and Mrs. McCormack!
Thank you. Thank you. Whatever station in society I attain through the learned profession of which I am about to become an unworthy member, I shall endeavor not to disgrace, and Mrs. McCormack will be sure to adore. On Monday next, on the arrival of the 4 o'clock afternoon coach at Canterbury, my foot will be on my native heath, my name McCormack. Your health. One thing more. On two occasions, my friend Mr. Thomas Traddles has put his name to bills of exchange for my accommodation.
Oh, please, don't...
On the first occasion, Mr. Traddles was left, let me say, in short, in the lurch. The fulfillment of the second has not yet arrived. The two sums united make a total amounting to £41.10.11½. To leave the metropolis without acquitting myself of this obligation would weigh on my mind to an insupportable extent.
Oh, I do assure you it's...
I therefore beg to hand to my friend Mr. Traddles my IOU for 41, 10, 11 and a half. And thus, I am happy to recover my moral dignity and to know that I can once more walk erect before my fellow men. Mr. Traddles, I wish you well.
Why, thank you.
And so we parted with great heartiness on both sides. As yet, my beloved Dora knew nothing of my altered circumstances, and I felt I should not announce them by letter. On a particular Saturday, therefore, I arranged to take tea with Dora and Miss Mills, who duly left us alone together. Dora, my darling.
Yes, Dodie.
Tell me, could you ever love a beggar?
Love a beggar? What do you mean? How can you ask me such a silly question?
My dearest, I am a beggar.
Whoa. Now, Dodie, don't sit there telling such stories.
My life, I am your ruined David.
Dodie.
I have no money now. I have no prospects. I'm a poor man. I thought it right to tell you so. My love, if you want to be released from our engagement, I would quite understand. No, don't cry. Dearest, please, don't cry. I couldn't bear it if I lost you. If you can face poverty with me, it has no terrors. Is your heart still mine?
Oh, yes. It's all yours.
Oh.
But don't be so dreadful. Don't talk about being poor.
My dearest love, the crust well earned.
I didn't want to hear about crusts. Jip must have a mutton chop every day at 12 or he'll die.
But he shall have it. I'll work hard for you and we'll have our own little house. But we must be practical.
Don't talk about being practical. It frightens me.
Sweetheart, you mustn't be alarmed. Perseverance and strength of character will help us bear it.
But I haven't got any strength at all. Have I, Jip? Oh, do kiss Jip and be reasonable.
Jip. But I must ask you, my darling, to think sometimes, not despondently, that you are engaged to a poor man. If you sometimes thought of that and looked now and then at your father's housekeeping...
Housekeeping?
And tried to get used to keeping accounts. And if you promise me to read a little cookery book that I will send you...
Oh, no!
Oh, Dora, my heart... Don't. I didn't mean to.
Dora. Nathaniel, what has happened? What have you done? Oh, Dora, dearest, what is the matter?
Dodie wants to buy me a cookery book.
Oh, poor Dora.
He said I should learn to keep counts.
Oh, I'm sure he didn't mean it. You didn't, did you, Mr. Copperfield?
Well, no, but I...
He didn't mean it.
Dora, I don't want anything that you don't want. I am so sorry.
Oh, Dodie. I must look such a fright.
No. You look beautiful.
Oh. Go and bathe your eyes, dear. Mr. Copperfield has said he's sorry.
Very well. I'm sorry too, Dodie. Truly.
Oh, my own. Oh. Miss Mills, I'm so distressed. I never meant to upset her.
No.
but my prospects have suffered a reverse, and I thought I should warn her that she won't be marrying a wealthy man. I only suggested that perhaps, thinking of the future, it might be wise if she...
Mr. Copperfield, I do understand. But we must both remember that dear Dora is not made to face the harsh realities of life. She is a thing of light and joy, and should only know happiness.
And indeed, when Dora returned, she looked so lovely that I could only agree. I loved Dora, and I went on loving her. But I sometimes wondered how I was to cut my way through the forest of difficulty, unaided. I soon discovered that the trees in that forest had grown yet thicker and stronger. Mr. Spenlow met me at the office door looking extremely grave and coldly requested me to accompany him to a certain coffee house near St. Paul's churchyard. We went into an upstairs room and I found an old enemy already there.
Miss Murdstone, have the goodness to show Mr. Copperfield what you have in your reticule. Thank you. Mr. Copperfield, I believe that is your writing.
It is, sir.
The other letters, Mr. Murdstone. Thank you. These two are from your pen, are they not?
Yes.
No, don't give them back to me, Mr. Copperfield. I will not deprive you of them. Miss Murdstone, be so good as to proceed.
I must confess to having entertained suspicions of Miss Spenlow in reference to David Copperfield for some time. I observed Miss Spenlow and David Copperfield when they first met, and the impression made upon me then was not agreeable. The depravity of the human...
You oblige me, ma'am, by confining yourself to facts.
Indeed. Since I am to confine myself to facts, I will state them as dryly as I can. I had tried to find confirmation of the suspicions I have mentioned without effect. I therefore forbore to mention them to Miss Spenlow's father, knowing how little disposition there is in such cases to acknowledge the conscientious discharge of duty.
Quite so.
On my return after my brother's marriage, Miss Spenlow's manner gave me even greater occasion for suspicion, but still I found no proof until last night. It appeared to me that Miss Spenlow received too many letters from her friend, Miss Mills. But Miss Mills being her friend with her father's full concurrence, it was not for me to interfere. Last evening, however, after tea, I observed the little dog rolling and growling about the drawing room, worrying something. Miss Spenlow gave a cry and ran to the dog, but I intervened, and at the risk of being bitten, I obtained possession of that letter. Miss Spenlow attempted to bribe me with kisses and small articles of jewelry. That I pass over. After reading the letter, I taxed Miss Spenlow with having many such letters in her possession, and eventually obtained from her the packet which is now in David Copperfield's hand.
You have heard, Miss Murdstone, Mr. Copperfield? Have you anything to say in reply?
There is nothing I can say, sir, except all the blame is mine. Dora did...
Miss Spenlow, if you please.
Miss Spenlow was induced and persuaded by me to consent to this concealment, and I bitterly regret it. But I love Miss Spenlow so much...
Don't tell me to my face that you love my daughter.
Could I defend my conduct if I did not?
Can you defend your conduct if you do? Have you considered your years and my daughter's years? Have you considered what it is to undermine the confidence that should subsist between my daughter and myself? Have you considered my daughter's station in life? The projects I may consider for her? The testamentary intentions I may have with reference to her? Have you considered anything, Mr. Copperfield?
Very little, I'm afraid, sir. When I explained my altered position to you, the concealment into which I'd unhappily led Miss Spenlow had already begun. Since I've been in that altered position, I've strained every nerve to improve it. I'm sure I shall improve it in time. Will you grant me time?
We're both so young and...
You're right. You are both very young. Let there be an end of the nonsense. Take away those letters and throw them in the fire. Give me Miss Spenlow's letters to throw in the fire, and we'll agree to make no further mention of the past.
No!
Come, Mr. Copperfield. You don't want sense, and this is the sensible course.
I'm sorry, sir. I cannot agree. I love your daughter. Love is above all else.
Very well. I must try my influence with my daughter. Mr. Copperfield, you are probably aware that I am not altogether destitute of worldly possessions, and my daughter is my nearest and dearest relative.
Sir, I acknowledge my error in concealing our affection, but I hope you don't consider me mercenary, too.
No, no, no. I merely say that you probably know I have some property to bequeath to my child.
I certainly supposed so.
Every day we in the commons see the consequences of men's negligence and inconsistence in dealing with their testamentary arrangements. So, you cannot doubt that mine are made.
Indeed, sir. I don't doubt it.
If this silly business were not relinquished, I might be inclined to guard my child with suitable protections from any foolish step in the direction of marriage. Take a week to consider what I have said. Confer with Miss Trotwood or anybody with any knowledge of life. Take a week, Mr. Copperfield.
I confided everything to my aunt when I got home, and in spite of all she could say to me, went to bed despairing. I got up despairing and went straight to the commons. There was a small crowd outside, gazing at the windows, which were all shuttered. The clerks were in the office, but nobody was doing anything. The chief clerk, old Tiffy, shook his head as I came in.
This is a dreadful calamity, Mr. Copperfield.
What is it? What's the matter?
Don't you know?
No.
Mr. Spenlow.
What about him?
He's dead.
Oh.
Sit down, Mr. Copperfield. Fetch Mr. Copperfield a glass of water.
Yes, Mr. Tiffy. But how did it happen?
He dined in town yesterday and drove down in the Phaeton by himself, having sent his groom home by the coach, as he sometimes did, you know.
Yes.
The Phaeton went home without him. The horses stopped at the stable gate. The man went out with the lantern, but there was nobody in the carriage.
Had the horses run away?
The reins were broken, and they'd been dragging on the ground. The servants found Mr. Spenlow a mile off.
More than a mile off, Mr. Tiffy. Water, Mr. Copperfield.
Oh, thank you.
I believe you're right, yes. More than a mile off. Not far from the church. Lying partly on the roadside and partly on the path.
Oh.
Upon his face. Whether he fell out in a fit, or got out feeling ill before the fit came on, or even whether he was quite dead then, no one appears to know. If he breathed, certainly he never spoke. A doctor was called immediately, but it was quite useless.
I can't describe my feelings at the shock of his death, and the thought of Dora alone and grieving. But another shock was in store. Mr. Jorkins came to the office and enlisted our help. He asked Tiffy and myself to search the office for a will, as none had been found at Mr. Spenlow's house. There was no sign of one in the office either.
Mr. Spenlow was very difficult to move from the beaten track. I'm disposed to think that he had made no will.
But, Mr. Jorkins, I know he had.
You know?
The day I last saw him, he told me he had. He said his affairs were all settled.
Oh, dear. This looks unpromising.
Very unpromising.
Surely you don't doubt...
My good Mr. Copperfield, if you'd been in the Commons as long as I have, you'd know there was no subject on which men are so negligent and inconsistent.
But that's exactly what he said.
Oh, I should call that almost final. My opinion is, no will.
There was no will. And even more astonishing, Mr. Spenlow's affairs were in a most disordered state. The furniture and lease of his house had to be sold, and Tiffy, shaking his head, told me that after all debts were settled, he wouldn't give £1,000 for all the assets remaining. My main concern, of course, was Dora. Miss Mills told me that she was broken-hearted, and would say nothing when I was mentioned, but, oh, poor Papa. Two spinster aunts had taken her off to their home in Putney. I was at a loss, and so I resolved to go and see Agnes and seek her support and advice. When I arrived in Canterbury, I went straight to Mr. Wickfield's house, and I found Mr. Micawber working in a little room that used to be Uriah's office, and looming very large there in a legal-looking black suit.
My dear Copperfield, what a pleasure! What an unlooked-for gift from fate! You wish to see our friend Heap? I will conduct you.
No, thank you, Mr. Micawber. I know the house of old, remember. I'll find my own way upstairs. How do you like the law?
To a man possessed of the higher imaginative powers, the chief objection to legal studies is the amount of detail they involve. Even in our professional correspondence, the mind is not at liberty to soar to any exalted form of expression. Still, it is a great pursuit, a great pursuit.
How is Mrs. Micawber?
She is well, thank you, and so are our offspring. We have been fortunate enough to secure accommodation in our friend Heap's old abode. She would be delighted to see you there. It is humble, to quote a favourite expression of our friend Heap, but it may prove the stepping stone to more ambitious domiciliary accommodation.
And how are you getting on with our friend Heap?
One moment. My dear Copperfield, a man who labours under the pressure of pecuniary embarrassments is, with the generality of people, at a disadvantage. That disadvantage is not diminished when the pressure necessitates the drawing of stipendiary emoluments before those emoluments are strictly due and payable. All I can say is that my friend Heap has responded to appeals in a manner calculated to redound equally to the honour of his head and of his heart.
Oh, I shouldn't have supposed him to be very free with his money.
Pardon me? I speak of my friend Heap as I have experience.
I'm glad your experience is so favourable. Do you see much of Miss Wickfield?
My dear Copperfield, I must assure you that I am charmed with Miss Wickfield. She is a very superior young lady, a very remarkable attractions, graces, and virtues. I do homage to Miss Wickfield.
I'm glad of that.
If you had not assured us, my dear Copperfield, that D was your favourite letter, I should unquestionably have supposed it to be A.
Oh. And what of Mr. Wickfield?
Mr. Wickfield is, I dare say, a man of very excellent intentions, but he is... In short, he is obsolete.
I'm afraid his partner tries to make him so.
My dear Copperfield, allow me to make a remark. I am here in a capacity of confidence. I am here in a position of trust. The discussion of some topics, even with Mrs. Micawber, so long the partner of my vicissitudes and a woman of remarkable lucidity of intellect, is incompatible with the functions now devolving upon me. I would therefore take the liberty of suggesting that in our friendly intercourse, which I trust will never be disturbed, we draw a line. On one side of the line is the whole range of the human intellect, with one trifling exception. On the other is that exception. The affairs of Wickfield and Heap, with all appertaining thereto. I trust I give no offence to the companion of my youth.
Of course not. I've no right to be offended by that.
I took my leave of Mr. Micawber, feeling that he was not quite at ease, and that something had interposed between him and me that had changed our relationship. I found Agnes sitting alone in her own little room, writing at her desk.
Trotwood, how good it is to see you.
Oh, Agnes, I've missed you so much.
Oh.
I don't know what it is. I seem to lack some resource that I ought to have. I need you to supply it.
What resource is that?
I don't quite know, but I must lack something. I get so miserable and worried. You come to London, I rely on you, and I have an object and a course ahead of me at once. I'm driven out of it. Then I come here, and in a moment I feel an altered person. Nothing has changed, but I have changed for the better. What is it? What is your secret?
Have I a secret?
When I come to you at last, I come to peace and happiness.
What has happened, Trot?
Mr. Spenlow found my letters to Dora. He forbade our engagement.
Oh, no.
But there's worse. Agnes, he's dead. He had some sort of attack on his way home.
Oh.
Dora is living with her aunt, her father's sisters. My darling girl is distraught with grief, and I haven't seen her since it happened. There you have it. Now my reliance is all on you.
But it mustn't be on me, Trot. It must be on someone else.
On Dora.
Of course.
Agnes, Dora is rather difficult to... I wouldn't for the world say to rely on, for she's the soul of purity and truth, but I hardly know how to express it. She's a timid little thing, easily frightened. A little while ago, before her father's death, I thought it right to tell her of the change in my fortunes. I told her she'd be marrying a poor man. I asked her to try and learn something about keeping accounts, to study a cookery book. She burst into tears and wouldn't talk about it.
Oh, Trotwood, just your old headlong way. Poor Dora. You needn't have been so very sudden with a timid, loving, inexperienced girl.
Yes. Yes, I see that now. But, Agnes, what ought I to do?
I think you should write to her aunts. I would tell them, quite openly, all that has happened, and ask their permission to visit at their house. Don't propose too much. Trust to your own fidelity and to Dora.
But suppose they frighten her? Suppose she cries and says nothing about me?
Is that likely?
God bless her. She's as easily scared as a bird. And suppose the two Miss Spenlows aren't likely persons to appeal to in that way?
I don't think I'd consider that. Consider whether it's right to do this. And if it is, do it.
You're so wise. You always are. I'll write the letter at once. And I did as I'd promised. Mr. Wickfield had invited me to stay, but unfortunately I had no further private conversation with Agnes then, for Mrs. Heap seemed to be with us everywhere.
Hold the wool for me while I wind it, Yuri.
Yes, Mother.
How do you think my Yuri's looking, Mr. Copperfield?
Very, unchanged, Mrs. Heap.
Oh, thank you, Master Copperfield.
Really? Oh, don't you see a thinness in him?
Not more than usual.
Don't you, though? Oh, but you don't take notice of him with a mother's eye. Don't you see him thin, Miss Wickfield?
No, he looks very well. You worry too much.
Oh, thank you, Miss Wickfield. You see, Mother? We're quite a little family now, Mr. Copperfield. Mother and me, and Miss Agnes, and her dear father.
I found this a very unwelcome domestic picture. Next day, Mrs. Heap's watching began again, and lasted all day. Towards twilight, I went for a walk alone. But I hadn't gone very far before Uriah caught me up.
Master Copperfield, how fast you walk. My legs are pretty long, but you've given them quite a job.
Where are you going?
I'm going with you, if you allow me the pleasure of a walk with an old acquaintance.
To tell you the truth, I hope you won't be offended, but I came out to walk alone because I've had so much company today.
You mean Mother?
Yes, I do.
Oh, but you know we're so very humble, and having such a knowledge of our own humbleness, we must take care we're not pushed to the wall by them that isn't humble. All's fair in love, sir.
What?
You see, you're quite a dangerous rival, Master Copperfield. You always were, you know.
Do you set a watch on Miss Wickfield and make her home no home because of me?
Those are very harsh words, Master Copperfield.
Put it how you like, you know what I mean.
No. You must put it into words. I couldn't.
Do you think I look on Miss Wickfield otherwise than as a very dear sister?
You may not, you know. But then again, you may.
Then, for the sake of Miss Wickfield...
My Agnes. Would you be so good as to call her Agnes?
Mr. Copperfield?
For Agnes Wickfield's sake. I'll tell you, I'm engaged to another young lady.
Oh?
I hope that contents you.
Upon your soul?
Yes.
Oh, Master Copperfield. If you'd only had the condescension to return my confidence when I poured out my heart before your sitting room fire. As it is, I'll take Mother off directly, and only too happy. What a pity you didn't return my confidence. But you've never condescended to me as much as I could have wished. I know you've never liked me as I've liked you.
You're right.
Yes?
You ought to understand. I believe Miss Wickfield to be as far above you, as far removed from your aspirations as that moon is up there.
Oh. Peaceful, ain't she? Now, confess, Master Copperfield, that you haven't liked me quite as I've liked you. All along you thought me too humble.
I'm not fond of professions of humility or professions of anything else.
There now. Didn't I know it? But how little you think of the rightful humbleness of a person in my station, Master Copperfield. Father and me was both brought up at a foundation school for boys. They taught us a deal of humbleness and not much else. We was to be humble to this person and humble to that, and to pull our caps off and make bows, and always to know our place and abase ourselves before our betters. And we have such a lot of betters. Be humble, Uriah, says Father to me, and you'll get on. It's what goes down best. Be humble, says Father, and you'll do. And really, it ain't done bad. People like to be above you, says Father. Keep yourself down. I'm very humble to the present moment, Master Copperfield. But I've got a little power.
As I saw his face in the moonlight, I knew he was resolved to recompense himself by using that power. When we three men were left alone after dinner, his spirit seemed high. On the pretext of welcoming me, he tried to entice his partner to drink more heavily, and unfortunately, he succeeded. It made me sick at heart to see it.
Come, fellow partner, I'll give you a toast. To the divinest of her sex.
What? What's this?
I admire and adore her. Agnes Wickfield is, I am safe to say, the divinest of her sex. To be her father is a proud distinction, but to be her husband...
What's the matter? You've not gone mad, Mr. Wickfield.
If I say I've an ambition to make your Agnes my Agnes... I've a gooder right to it as another man. I've a better right than any other man.
No, no! God, troubled. Hear him! My daughter, my Agnes!
Hush, sir, hush. Think of her. Spare her such a scene as this. I know how you love her.
My darling child. And him! Look at him! Look at my torturer! Through him I've abandoned my name, my reputation, my peace, and my home.
Oh, I've kept your name and reputation for you, and your peace, and your home, too.
No.
Don't be foolish. If I've gone a little beyond what you were prepared for, I can go back. There's no harm done.
Oh, see what he is! See what he is!
You'd better stop him, Copperfield. He'll say something presently he'll be sorry to have said.
I'll say anything! Why shouldn't I be in all the world's power if I'm in yours?
I tell you, if you don't stop his mouth, you're not his friend. Why shouldn't you be in all the world's power, Mr. Wickfield? Because you've got a daughter. You and me know what we know, don't we? Let sleeping dogs lie. Who wants to rouse them? I don't. I tell you, if I've gone too far, I'm sorry.
Oh, Trotwood. What have I come down to be since I first saw you? I've brought misery on what I dearly love. See the ruin I am and hate me. shunned me. I don't know all I've done, but he knows, for he's always been at my elbow, whispering to me. You heard him. What need have I to say more?
You hadn't need to say so much. Not half so much. Not anything at all. You wouldn't have took it up so if it hadn't been for the wine. You'll think better of it tomorrow, sir.
Papa, you're not well.
No.
Come with me.
I didn't expect he'd cut up so rough, Master Copperfield. But it's nothing. I'll be friends with him tomorrow. It's for his good. I'm humbly anxious for his good.
Trotwood, you're still up.
I was reading. Agnes.
You leave early in the morning.
Dearest, Agnes.
Let's say goodbye now.
I see. You don't want to speak about tonight. But is there nothing that can be done?
There is God to trust in.
It's presumptuous of me to try to influence you, but you know how much I love you, how much I owe you. Agnes, you'll never sacrifice yourself to a mistaken sense of duty.
What?
Think what a priceless gift a love like yours would be. Say you have no such thought.
You need have no fears for me. I have no fears for myself. Good night, Trotwood.
Copperfield? Copperfield?
Yes?
I thought you'd be glad to hear we've made it all smooth. Why, though I'm humble, I'm useful to him, you know. What an agreeable man he is, Master Copperfield.
I'm glad you've made your apologies.
Oh, to be sure. When a person's humble, what's an apology? So easy. I suppose you've sometimes plucked a pear before it was ripe, Master Copperfield?
I suppose I have.
I did that last night. But it'll ripen yet. It only wants attending to. I can wait. Goodbye, Mr. Copperfield. Remember me to your aunt, a most strong-minded lady and very attached to Miss Agnes, I'm glad to say.
On my return to London, I received a letter from Dora's aunt.
The Mrs. Spenlow presents their compliments to Mr. Copperfield and begs to inform him that they have given his letter their best consideration with a view to the happiness of both parties. If he will do them the favour to call, accompanied by a confidential friend, on Saturday the 23rd of this month, they will be happy to hold some conversation on the subject. Gentlemen, pray be seated. Mr. Copperfield, I presume?
No, I'm Traddles. I'm David Copperfield.
Mr. Copperfield, my sister Lavinia, being conversant with matters of this nature, will speak for both of us.
We will not discuss the past history of this matter. Our poor brother Francis's death has cancelled that. We have no reason to doubt, Mr. Copperfield, that you are an honourable young gentleman of good character, and that you have an affection, or are persuaded that you have an affection, for our niece.
I love Miss Spenlow. No one could ever love more.
Mr. Copperfield, we have shown your letter to our niece and discussed it with her. We have no doubt that you think you like her very much.
Thanks, Mum.
One minute, Mr. Copperfield.
I beg your pardon?
Mature affection does not easily express itself. It is modest and retiring. It waits and waits. Sometimes a life goes by and finds it still ripening in the shade. I know too well. But no matter.
Lavinia, my dear.
Forgive me. In comparison, the light inclinations of young people are as dust compared to rocks. It is owing to the difficulty of knowing whether they have any real foundation that my sister Clarissa and myself have been very undecided how to act.
But my love for Dora is not a light affection. I can't express how much I love her. Since I met her, I have become more serious, more earnest, more determined to do well in life for her sake.
All my friends know this.
Mr. Copperfield is speaking the truth, ma'am. I speak as one who has some little experience being engaged to a young lady in Devonshire. Her name is Sophie. Oh, she really is the dearest girl. But we see no prospect at the moment of our engagement coming to fruition.
Then, Mr. Traddles, you can confirm what I have said of the affection that is modest and retiring, that waits and waits.
Entirely, ma'am.
Oh.
It seems to us prudent, Mr. Traddles, to bring these young people's feelings to the test of our observation. Therefore, we are inclined to allow Mr. Copperfield's visits here.
I shall never forget your kindness.
But we do not yet recognize any positive engagement between Mr. Copperfield and our niece. And we prefer to regard these visits as made at present to us. Sister Clarissa, the rest is with you.
We shall be happy to see Mr. Copperfield to dinner every Sunday. Our hour is 3. In the course of the week, we shall be happy to see Mr. Copperfield to tea on 2 occasions, not oftener. Our hour is 6. Miss Trotwood, mentioned in Mr. Copperfield's letter, will perhaps call upon us.
I'm sure my aunt would be delighted.
And now, Mr. Copperfield, if you would like to follow me, I am of the opinion that our niece would wish to see you.
Miss Lavinia took me into another room, where I found my blessed Dora in tears, and Jip in a state of high indignation.
Oh, dear. Oh, Toadie.
My dearest. Oh, don't cry. Now you're mine forever.
Don't, please.
Aren't you mine forever?
Oh, yes. Indeed, I am. But I'm so frightened. And I don't like him. Why won't he go?
Who?
Your friend. It isn't any business of his. What a stupid he must be.
But Traddles is the best creature.
I don't want any best creatures.
Oh, you'll soon know him well and like him very much. And my aunt's coming soon. And you'll like her too when you know her.
No, please don't bring her. I'm sure she's a naughty, mischief-making old thing.
But of course, when my aunt did call, she got on very well with Dora's aunt, and was very fond of Dora herself, who soon admitted she wasn't a naughty, mischief-making old thing at all.
I think your Dora is a very tender little blossom, and the wind must be gentle with her, Trot.
One thing troubled me. It seemed to me that everybody, Dora's aunt and my aunt too, treated my darling as if she were a pretty toy, a kind of plaything. My aunt always called her Little Blossom, and the pleasure of Miss Lavinia's life was to curl Dora's hair, make ornaments for her, and treat her like a pet child. I wish they'd behave differently to you, dearest, because you're not a child, you know.
Oh, now you're going to be cross. They're very kind to me, and I'm very happy.
But you might still be happy and be treated differently.
If you don't love me, why did you get engaged to me?
Not love you?
Why don't you go away now if you can't bear me?
Oh, I dote upon you, my dearest. You know that.
And don't find fault with me.
Dora, suppose we were married.
Yes?
And you were going to buy a shoulder of mutton for dinner. Would you know how to buy it?
How to buy it?
Yes.
Why, the butcher would know how to sell it, wouldn't he? So there's no need for me to know anything, you silly boy.
Well, we fell back on flower painting and singing to the guitar, and my cookery book was put in the corner for Jip to stand on. We were as happy as the week was long, although summer had passed and winter was upon us now. One night when I left Dr. Strong's house, I found it was snowing heavily. I walked home as I usually did, and naturally took the shortest route, which led me through St. Martin's Lane. As I went down towards the Strand, I noticed a passing face, a woman's face, and thought that I had some association with it, but I couldn't remember what. On the steps of the church, there was the stooping figure of a man. He had put some burden down on the snow to adjust it, but as I passed by, he rose and turned towards me. It was Mr. Peggotty.
Master Davy! Oh, it
Do my heart good to see you. Well met.
Well met, my dear old friend.
I had my thoughts of coming to make inquirations for you tonight, but I'd been down Yarmouth way, and I heard as your aunt was living along you, so I was afraid it was too late. I would have come early in the morning, sir, before going away.
Going away?
Mm.
Again?
Yep. I'm away tomorrow.
Where are you going now?
We're going to turn in somewhere.
There's an inn I know across the way. The Golden Cross. It has public rooms where we can talk. Come. Come with me. Drink this, Mr. Peggotty. It'll warm you.
Oh. Thank you kindly, sir.
You'll have nothing stronger than ale.
No, sir. Thank you, sir. Now, I'll tell you where all I've been and what all we've heard. I've been far and we've heard little, but I'll tell you. When Emily was a child, she used to talk to me a deal about the sea, about them coasts where the sea got to be dark blue and lay shining in the sun. And I knowed in my mind as he'd take her to them countries. He'd have told her wonders on them and how she was to be a lady there. So I went across the channel to France.
As he spoke, I saw the door move and the snow drift in. It moved a little more, and a hand softly interposed to keep it open.
I went on my way through France.
Alone? And on foot?
But mainly afoot, sometimes in carts, along with people going to market. At the villages, I'd find the inn and wait about the yard till someone come or spoke English. Mostly someone did. I told them I was seeking my niece. They told me what manner of gentlefolk was in the house. But it were never her. The poor folk helped me. They'd set me down at their cottage doors and give me for to eat and drink. Many a woman had a daughter. About Emily's age. Oh, my darling girl.
There was a face at the door. The woman's face I had passed by the church. And now I knew her. It was the lost soul Emily had wept for. Martha.
At last, I come to the sea. Well, it weren't hard for a seafaring man like me to work his way over to Whitley. The people was just as good to me there. But then, I got news of her being seen among them Swiss mountains. One as knowed his servant. See them there, all three. I made for the mountains, Master Davy. But when I reached the place, they told me as I was too late, they'd gone. So I come home.
How long ago?
After 5 days, there were some letters. This first one come afore I'd been gone a week. A £50 bank note in a sheet of paper directed to me and put underneath the door in the night. She tried to hide her writing, but she could never hide it from me. Then, this come from Mrs. Gummidge. Read it, sir.
Thank you.
There were £5 with it. I've kept it with the rest. I'll touch none on it.
She says, write to me some news of Uncle. Was there an address?
There was some light instructions, sir. It seemed it was written close to the places I'd heard in them. Well, Mrs. Gummidge and Ham wrote. They told her I were gone to seek her, and my parting words.
Is that another letter?
More money, sir. £10. This came day before yesterday. I'm a-going to seek her at the postmark, see?
It's the town on the Upper Rhine.
Ah, yeah. There was foreign gentlemen in Yarmouth, dealers who knowed it. They give me a map. I showed it Ham and told him where I were going.
How is Ham?
Oh, he worked as hard as a man can. His name is as good as any man's anywhere in the world. But it's cut him deep. He's no care for his life now. when there's our duty to be done with danger in it, he stepped forward afore all his mates. Well, I haven't seen you tonight, Master Davy. I'll be away early tomorrow. All that troubles me is to think that some harm might come to me afore that money was given back to him. I'd go 10,000 miles, I'd go till I drop dead to lay that money down afore him. If I do that and find my Emily, I'm content.
As we left the inn, I saw a figure flit away quickly before us. Martha. I took Mr. Peggotty over Westminster Bridge and parted from him on the Surrey shore. Then I went back to the inn yard and looked round, searching for the listener. But she was gone. The snow had covered our late footprints. My new track was the only one to be seen. And even as I looked back, that too had begun to die away.
Part 7 of David Copperfield from the novel by Charles Dickens. It featured Gary Cady, Miriam Margolyes, Harold Innocent, Sheila Hancock, David Burke, and Oriel Smith. Also Jane Wittenshaw, Maria Miles, Mark Straker, Phil Daniels, Maria Charles, Timothy Bateson, and Peter Penry Jones, with Ronald Herdman, James Green, Timothy Carlton, David Bannerman, Anne Windsor, Irene Sutcliffe, Una Beeson, and Nigel Carrington. The book was dramatised by Betty Davis, and the producer was Marilyn Imrie.